Good evening. Welcome back to Writers at Warwick. Something I take a lot of pleasure in is the memory of reading Helen Dunmore's name for the first time. It was attached to a poem called The Dream Life of Priests. It had been submitted to a poetry competition, which I'm proud to say I began, the TLS Cheltenham Poetry Prize, and it won that prize that year, and then was published in a collection called Short Days, Long Nights, in 1991. That all seems a very long time ago now, and one of the things that's struck me only just today, really, having kept pretty close contact with Helen Dunmore's career as a writer from a distance, simply as a reader, over these years. But something that struck me today is that since 93, which as it happens is when I came to Warwick, Helen has produced this body, this substantial and immensely powerful body of fiction, beginning with Zenna in Darkness in 93 and going on through another five works of fiction, one book of short stories and the others novels. This is quite apart from her poetry and her writing for children. She is an immensely powerful, as I said, physical, vivid, tender writer. She's somebody who, in some ways, a quite traditional format, deals with inexpressible pain and suffering, except that, of course, it's not inexpressible because she expresses it, and manages to reconcile in her work the hard things she sees with a clear eye, with a great deal of beauty and, as I said, tenderness. I can't think of any body of work over a comparable period of time, over that period of time, that has more substance in British writing. And I can't think of any British writer whose work I would recommend to a wider range of people with more confidence than Helen's. So it's a personal pleasure and a privilege to have her here this evening. Now, Helen is going to read to us, and then, as is usual here, she'll take questions, and after that you'll have an opportunity to come and get copies signed, and indeed to buy books if you'd like to later on. So welcome, Helen.
Thank you. I'm going to read from the lectern, not for formality, but because I always feel more comfortable somehow standing up. And I'm going to read from my last novel to be published, which is called Your Blue-Eyed Boy. I hope you can all hear comfortably at the back, but do please say if you can't, because I know my voice tends to be on the soft side. And if it does drop down, do shout from the back of the auditorium. It's quite difficult always to choose pieces from a novel, because you could begin at the beginning and read until you get fed up or your audience does, but what I've tried to do is to select passages which give some sense of the narrative texture and also of the writing and, you know, how I'm putting the story together. So to introduce it, Your Blue-Eyed Boy is a book about blackmail. And it's about a woman who's in a position of power. She is a district judge, which is, you know, not a very high judge, but high enough to be noticeable. And she's a woman who has had to take over the economic support of her family because her husband's business has failed. So in a sense, she's exposed and has many burdens on her in two directions. She didn't particularly want to enter the judiciary. She was happy in a legal aid practice, but she has done so, and she wants to do so to the best of her ability. But what happens then is she begins to receive messages, first of all letters, and then telephone calls from the past. So what I'm looking at is how your past can interact with your present and how it can collide with it. I think probably most of us have things hidden away in our past that we very, very much hope that nobody will ever find out about. Those boxes will remain sealed. And particularly if we're getting into positions where we're worth a few headlines. And Simone is terrified, you know, the saucy secrets of sexy Judge Simone will be all over the front page of The Sun or the News of the World. So I'm going to read to you passages beginning in the past and going back to the present. When Simone was 18, she went to New England for a summer, and she had a relationship, a very sexual, very passionate relationship, with a man 10 years older than her called Michael. And he's the figure who later returns to threaten her and to haunt her. You can't hear there. Is that better? If I'm nearer to the microphone. Okay, I'll stay closer to the microphone. Michael, who was 28 at the time of the Vietnam War, is in a way permanently damaged by his experiences there. But that is also a very lyrical and a very beautiful summer between them. So the first thing I'm going to read to you is a passage set in New England in that summer over 20 years before. Now, the most perfect days begin, so few that you can weigh each one of them in your hand like a new-laid egg. The nights are cool and the mornings misty, because the sea is warmer than the land. The mist carries a tang of autumn until the sun strengthens and burns it away. The evenings are bluer now, the sun ripe and yellow as a pear. At the store there are no queues, and this conversation again, lazy and convalescent. The days smell of dried seaweed and tar and anti-fouling paint and new sweet wood planed away in long shavings. There's the whine of a drill, the steady rasp of the plane. Simone sits back on her heels on the dock and watches Michael as he applies paint in long, supple strokes. He's repainting the cabin exterior on the Boussac's cabin cruiser. The Boussac's are back in New York. Michael sweeps the brush, and Simone listens to the sound it makes, like the lick of a rough tongue. She shivers, though it is warm in the pool of sun where she sits. The boat, the heat, the smell of paint, it all belongs to them now. She squints and watches the muscles in Michael's forearm. He is precise. He is a fine workman. He has that reputation. He turns to look at her. Sunlight is getting onto the water now, making it dance. He shades his eyes with the hand that doesn't hold the brush. Does he smile? Maybe he smiles. He turns back to her paint, to his work. She watches him. His hair has slipped forward round his face. If she was nearer, she would smell the sun on him, his sweat, and the t-shirt she brought in from the porch rail that morning. Damp, but he put it on anyway. It smelt of night air. Michael's got plenty of work lined up for the winter. People from the city ask him why he stays here in Annasset. It's beautiful, and they love it. But a little place like this must be dead in winter. And most of the young people move away. Kids go to college and they don't come back. Michael looks up at them from whatever he's doing, though his hands don't stop their work. I already went away. That's why I'm back, he says. And then usually they don't ask anymore, because they know a bit of the story. It's their story too. They watch the way his hands move, and they want Michael working on their boat, not anyone else. The season's nearly over. There's time for the jobs that can't be done when the boats are out every day. The privately owned boats and the fishing boats and tourist boats that have to be out all day long in the summer months, making the money to last the winter. In the mornings, Simone's bare legs are cold as she runs down to the boathouse. everybody's going home, but not Simone. She'll stay on through the apple season and the pumpkin season, waiting until the rowing boats are hauled up on shore and the boathouse is padlocked. She tucks her feet under her. She sighs. There is the dock with its pale, washed-out wood, the sea that scarcely moves but glistens like a great creature that has risen up to breathe. If she looks close, she will see its flanks moving. It is full of fish and whales that pass without stopping, far out to sea, going south. Is that true? She doesn't know what's true anymore, only what Michael has told her. And I'm going to move on now to Simone as an adult woman. And she is a judge. And she's trying on her wig. Now, it's quite difficult to get a wig when you're a judge. I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but there's only a couple of places that get it. And you have to measure yourself very carefully. And then it comes back, and you put it on, and you hope it looks okay. I take off my wig and settle it into the shiny box with my name on it, then clip the box shut, reach into the cupboard, and put it on the top shelf. My head feels cool and light. I look into the mirror as I comb out my hair. The wig has crushed it flat, so that for a moment, my mother's face peeps back at me. I reach up again, take out the wig, resettle it on my head. It fits perfectly. It should do. All the measuring we did, following the wig maker's diagrams. They haven't changed this leaflet in 50 years, my husband Donald said, poring over it, except to give the measurement in centimetres. We stared at the illustrated head. It was lofty, trustworthy, like a phrenologist's advertisement, not a familiar head at all. That's because it's completely symmetrical, Donald said. No human head is like that. Come over here by the mirror and I'll measure you. We had a piece of squared paper and the maker's instructions. Donald measured me from nape to crown, from crown to chin, over temple and forehead. The tape tickled as it ran over my nose. Donald jotted down each measurement and then read them back to me. It sounds a lot, I said. It's in centimetres, that's why. Or maybe I have a huge head. Do it again, to be sure. It's so expensive if we make a mistake. The measurements were not quite the same the second time. It's the tape, Donald said. It's been in your sewing box forever. Look how worn it is. Why do we never have decent scissors or tape measures in this house? And those bloody boys have taken my masking tape again. I wouldn't mind if they ever did anything sensible with it. It doesn't matter, I said, as long as it fits more or less, as long as it doesn't fall off. But Donald frowned and compared the figures again. He was always more exact than I was. It's your hair that's the problem as well, he said. I'm not sure how much I should press down your hair to get the measurements right. These measurements will be geared to men. Their hair won't be as thick as yours. That's what the wig maker will be allowing for. I slicked my hair flat with both hands. I'll hold it down while you measure again. But that won't be how you wear it in court. His face was very close to me. His skin was fine, but I saw the wear on it, the way it crinkled dryly when he frowned. Donald would go on for an hour or more to get the measurements right, and I was tired standing. Since the boys had been born, I'd been able to walk any distance, but I found it hard to stand still in one place. Just do it once more and split the difference, I said. He ran the tape round my head, pinched it still with a finger, and read off the measurement. Then he looked straight at me in the mirror and smiled. I never thought I'd be measuring my wife for a wig, he said. When the week came, I would have liked to go off by myself to try it on and get used to the face under it. But the boys were there, and Donald too. I unpacked it and held it up. It had tight rolls of horsehair riding on a dense scalp. It looked like an old drag queen's perm. My family crowded round, and Matt snatched up the wig, saying he was going to be the first to try it. Donald took it away from him. "Put it on, Simone. Let's see what it looks like." I was wearing jeans and a yellow t-shirt. I knew how the wig would look above them. "No," I said, "I'll try it later." Donald held the thing above my head like a crown. The boys laughed, egging him on. We could have a scene, or I could put the wig on at once, as if it didn't matter. "There," I said, settling it on my head. The tight band of the wig pressed my forehead, and I wondered if Donald had done the measurements right after all. The boys were staring at me. There was laughter in their faces still, but something else as well. "Jesus, Mum," said Matt. "You look like..." "Don't say Jesus," said Donald automatically. I looked straight into the mirror. My face stared back at me, knowing, severe, aloof. I was of any gender and any time. I was the judge. "A judge," went on Matt. "That's what she is," said my husband, but a faint astonishment coloured his voice. I smiled, then I let my face settle again. This face had no need to please. The wig got rid of my softness, the softness that makes people smile back at me when I'm not aware I'm even smiling. "Only a district judge," I said. "Take it off," said Joe. "Put it back in the box." "Why?" I asked him. His 8-year-old face creased with effort. Then he said, "Don't wear it at home, Mum. Keep it at work." I knew what he meant. "It's all right," I said. "It's not something I'll be wearing about the house." Matt muttered something into Joe's ear, and the pair of them began to choke and spurt, farting out laughter. "Go on out," said Donald. I touched the wig with my fingers, feeling the tightness and springiness of the curls. They were fixed in shape, and they would never unwind. "It suits you," Donald said. "You look good." I realised when I'd written the book that there's quite a lot about clothing in it, about transformations and how we can take on a role and we can completely alter ourselves. If you think about it, the judiciary, particularly in Britain, is one of the most ritualised ways of dressing that you can get. And it's interesting that Lord Irvine wants to do away with some of that, because the reasons why it is like that I find fascinating and subtle. It's in a way you depersonalize the person. You take away the individuality, you efface it, and you say you are not a person, you are a role. And you get this deference, and you get a huge amount of deference, as it were, automatically, not because of your individuality, but because of your garb and your role. And in a way, that's quite good for the ego, because the judge without the garb is not anything special, and is not, in fact, even recognisable. So it's a complex, double-sided argument about this clothes. And it's quite significant for Simone to take away that female softness and look at what then comes out. So quite a lot of the book is about the courtroom and about the procedures and about the cases that she's dealing with and how she reacts to that. I'm going to move on now to a passage where the blackmail is beginning to come closer. Michael is beginning not just to telephone her, but actually, not just to write to her, but in a sense a letter you can decide how you're going to handle it. But a telephone call you have to respond to straight away. And Simone is waiting to see how next is he going to contact her. I touch the phone as I go past it up the stairs. And again, I could have unplugged it. I think for a second about unplugging. Then it rings. Hi. It's his voice. A week ago I wouldn't have recognized it, but I've learnt it again. I turn so my body shields the rest of the house from the phone. Hi, I say back. I've got you at last. First I get your husband, then I get your kid. He sounds like a nice kid. I don't say anything. I make my listening attentive. I'll pull him to me along the currents of air that carry voices. I'll undo him with my listening. Simone, I'm here. Aren't you going to say anything? I wait again. A roar of TV laughter comes through the door. I hear Joe laugh loudly, consciously, proud that he has got the TV joke. Between Michael and me, the air sighs. It's been a bitch finding you again. Has it? I say. I wouldn't have thought it would be that difficult. I polish the base of the phone with my forefinger. I hear him breathe in. He's waiting too, for someone who doesn't exist anymore. How I used to pour myself down the phone to him, all warm and spilling and eager, hoping he would think me sexy. Well, I made it at last, he says. I'm talking to you. You know where I am. I can't picture it, he says. You could be anywhere. I say nothing again. I think he's telling me that he's going to come here. In this clutter of what isn't being said, I can pick out a few shapes. That's my training, after all. Did you cut your hair? He asks suddenly. No, it's still long. Matthew told me you were washing it when I called. That's right. I remember the way you used to wash your hair all the time. You told him anything about us? Does he know about you and me? He's climbing into my life, hand over hand, like a burglar. There's no you and me, I want to say, but this isn't the moment. All those years in my office upstairs with the fire burning, I've learned a lot about making silences for other people to talk into. It's what people don't know they're telling you that you need to hear. We are quiet for a while. The expensive silence ticks on. You know, Simone, the way you went, it wrecked me. I was out of my mind. Do you believe that? I say nothing. I hear him swallow. There was a storm 2 weeks after you left. I took off in the Susie-Anne. By the time I got her round the point and hit the wind, I knew I could be in trouble. The wind blew so hard, it was cutting lumps of water off the tops of the waves. They were hitting the boat like rocks. He's silent again. I see the boat buck. The water smashed into chaos by the wind fighting the tide. But you got back. Yeah, no matter how much you think, you don't care what happens. You find yourself fighting. I couldn't let her turn over and get broken up on the shore. You remember the Susie-Anne? You know I do, I say into the mouthpiece, barely moving my lips. My heart annoys me, bumping as hard as this, when I have nothing to be afraid of and my hands are sweating. I'm not sure where this conversation is taking us, I say, in a voice I know he's never heard before. He's quiet for a bit. Then I hear his voice again, bubbling through laughter. Oh, wow, here comes the judge. and that tells me all I need to know. He has really done his homework, and for a reason. And I remember the two of us watching Rowan and Martin's laughing, my bare feet tucked in Michael's lap, and the taste of beer from the bottle his lips had touched before mine. Sometimes I would see the bubble of his saliva and put my lips to it slowly for the shiver of pleasure it drove through my body. I've got to go now, I say. But we only just got started. You don't need to worry about the cost of the call. I've got plenty of money. He hasn't, of course he hasn't. But it's money that's in his mind, all right. The thought of money was waiting there all the time, just behind his tongue, and now it's slipped out. All I want is to talk to you, says Michael. And it sounds like the truth. He comes into my mind, all of him, his shirt off and his shoulders glistening, the plume of water pouring from the dipper, spilling onto his skin, the loose drops kicking onto the dust and dirt of the yard. And his eyes closed, his face peaceful. All of him there for once, and offered to me. The last little bit I'm going to read to you is about blackmail itself and what it does to you. Now, the bits that I've read to you are all from the early part of the book, for obvious reasons, because it gets so complex and tangled, really, as it goes on, that I would be trying to pluck too many threads in a reading. I mean, you can do it in a book, but you can't really do it in the reading. But Michael does come back into Simone's life, and he sets in motion, he precipitates a chain of events which is not only beyond his control, but probably beyond what either of them have imagined. And the book is driven by fear which changes. At first it's simply the fear of blackmail, and then I think it's the fear in Simone of what all these events are going to reveal to her about herself, about her past, about the life that she's built on it. So this is the last little bit I'm going to read to you, which is actually the prologue to the book. There are things you should know about blackmail in case it comes tapping at your door. There's what it does to you, and then there's what it makes you do. I used to think I knew what I could be made to do. When blackmail comes into your house, you can learn to live with it, feeding it as little as you dare, trying to guess what it will take to make it go away before it gets too big. Then you begin to realize that it will never go away. The more you feed it, the stronger it grows. Why should you feel guilty unless you've got something to hide? Why should you be afraid? Watch me shake out your life in front of you. You know what's in there, don't you? See what comes. Some blackmailers just want money. That's frightening, but at least you know where you are, and that a wad of used money is what you're talking about. I haven't got money. The others put on pressure without letting you know what they want. They steer you where you don't want to go, but in a way that's so intimate that you have to give in. They know more about you than you know about yourself. The pressure comes from what they don't say. They wait and wait until you can't wait anymore, and you'll do anything to know why they've come. It begins to seem like freedom. When blackmail comes tapping at the door, get up and open it. There'll be no one there. Just the yawn of a black night with wind in it, but no stars. Already, there's wind hurrying through the house, licking the back of your knees as you stare out. Where's it coming from? That window at the back, Someone's round there already, and through the slender gap like an eel. Already the curtains are whipping up, the doors are buckling, and the floorboards pitch and toss like the planks of a boat. The wind blows harder, and your house begins to move on a sea that was always there beneath the crust of the land. And you're afraid, but you are beginning to move with it. Thank you very much.
Well, I've got hundreds of questions, but there are a lot of you here, so what about you? First question, please. I'll repeat the questions, partly because people can't always hear across the room, and partly because the event's being recorded, and otherwise the question doesn't get recorded. But perhaps I could just kick things off while people are thinking, because they'll have your words so much in their minds that they won't instantly want to intrude in the way that I'm clumsily going to try and do. But that passage you read last, which is the introductory passage of the book, which is so thematic and densely wrought, one's bound to think of it in terms of your beginnings as a poet. I know that you don't like to be thought of as a poetic novelist, and I certainly, you know, I'm not talking about you writing prose poetry or something, but there is a clear relation between what you began doing as a poet and your development as a writer. What would you tell us about the things that aren't related, the things that writing fiction frees you to do, that you couldn't do as a poet, because that was obviously a decision you took?
Well, I think if I take, is it, can you hear me with this microphone? Is that clear?
Yes.
Yep, good. Okay. If you take that passage that I've just read, for example, in a sense, I'm trying to do something very fictional with it, which is to set a scene, to set a mood, and also to set up the image of the house. Mm-hmm. Houses are quite important in, not just in this book actually, in several of my books, the house being the place where you feel safe, the place that you've made your own, the place where you're inviolate. What I'm trying to do at the very beginning is to say everything in this book is up for grabs, everything is uncertain. And I'm really trying to find the most economical way of doing that, which is through an image, which is through the image of the house, which turns into a ship, which floats away, which takes you with it. So I suppose if I do use poetic technique, it's because it works best, rather than because I do it for the sake of it. And also there are some themes, like blackmail, for example, that touch very, very deep levels in everybody, and I don't mean just in me as a writer, but everyone who reads the book. I think we all have a fear of being uncovered. I mean, it's almost like a clothing idea that, you know, you clothe yourself to go out of the house, and you clothe yourself in life with a story about yourself, you know, about your, perhaps about your profession or your relationships, or, and blackmail is a way of stripping someone and taking off everything that they want to have around them. So it's a very, very powerful subject. And in a way, I see it more as an overture, actually, when I think about it, than a prologue. It's like you have the overture and you set the themes, and people will hear that again and again in the book, not often as dark as that, but they will hear that motif and that idea. And then at the end, they'll get a sort of reprise of it in the very last few pages again, because I think that people respond to fiction as they do to music in many ways, and people are very subtle in the way they read. They pick up all kinds of things, and sometimes you pick up things as a reader without even quite knowing that you've done it, and then later on you realise, oh yeah, that was there before, and I'm relating that to that. So I think as a writer, you're not trying to shove the reader around. you know, you're trying to help the reader to do best what they can do, rather than push them, perhaps. Oh, that's my feeling.
That's really interesting. Thanks. It strikes me that that unclothing idea, I mean, in this novel, your overture does tell people straight away what is coming. I mean, the key element of the plot. I mean, there's a whole lot more that's going to take us by surprise, but you tell us, you know, you undress the book straight away, if you like, there. Yeah. Other fiction of yours, I mean, thinking particularly of A Spell of Winter, is terribly tantalising and enigmatic, and you take the reader in very slowly, and we don't quite know what's going on, except we're very interested to know what's going on. So there's no overture, but a...
No, I think, probably like all writers, I'm trying to do different things all the time, and I think with this one I was very interested in the pace and the almost kind of thrillerish idea of the person who comes from nowhere, you know, the figure, this very, and in fact she meets him on a deserted piece of marshland by the sea, and she meets him on the seawall, and he comes out of the mist, and obviously that's a very Dickensian, you know, and I'm not unaware that it's a very Dickensian image, but I find those images extremely powerful, the idea of the figure, and then he comes out and you see that it's this big bulky man in a parka, and he's very, you know, it's in a way it's very banal, because writing about landscape, writing about events in that way, I think it's very powerful, because you're then hooking into a lot of things, fairy tale, myth, you know, things that we've come across, and then putting on top of it the story, which, you know, the particular story of these particular people, that's what I was trying to do anyway. So on one level, yes, she's a judge, she's got a family, she's busy, she's rushing around, she tries a wig on, she's wearing jeans, you know, it's very domestic and immediate. And on another level, she could be anybody. She's a figure, you know, she could be any blackmailed woman reacting very, very primitively, and she wants to protect herself and she wants to protect her children, and there's something very primeval about that, I think. So where's the civilization beginning and ending? But I can see that it's quite difficult for people to ask questions about a book they haven't read, so small problem.
There may be questions simply about how you got going as a writer, or about what it's like being a writer. So questions that aren't specific to the work. And so if you're,
I'd be delighted to answer it.
Here as well.
Yeah.
So the question is about whether the issues and themes come first, or the situation and the character.
I think the what perhaps came first in this book was the idea of your past catching up with you, and of having something hidden away that you really couldn't bear to come out. Then the other thing I wanted to write about, it was more thematic, as you were saying. It was the whole idea of how do we resolve conflict? Because the book is about war and about law, the two things, the two classic human ways of resolving conflict. So I've made Simone is the judge, and that's partly because I find the law very interesting, and I believe quite a few people find the operation of the law and how the law works in its intricacy. And that scene with the wig, now that was something that I'd done because my husband was sitting as a deputy district judge, and we had to measure for the wig, and it was a very funny thing. We found it very amusing domestically, you know, running around getting a tape measure, and we kept thinking we got it wrong, and then seeing the wig and what it did. And he told me something about going into, this would have been in a county court, and he was just walking down the corridor towards the court, and there was a clerk or someone, and the clerk just moved back against the wall to let him go past. And it was an abstract thing, and I put that into the book. It's got nothing to do with your own self. It is, we have created something called the law to resolve conflict, And how does it work and how do we make it work? And I found that fascinating. So to have a woman who's right in the thick of that, in a way, and who's trying to make decisions which are very important for people's future, and trying to decide all these things all the time. And then to have her involved with someone who's been in a war, a young man who's been kind of, he's had a private life, and then suddenly he's kind of gone into a war, which was history, which was called the Vietnam War, and we see it as a historical thing. So it's like collisions everywhere. And the law is all about collision and resolution. And when law breaks down, you have violence. So that's a lot of what I'm interested in writing about.
Sure.
But I don't like to write about it in a very kind of, oh, you know, this is my theme, and isn't it complicated? I want it to be alive through the characters rather than through, you know, this is the, these are the ideas of the book, really. So to answer your question, it's probably moments, it's probably scenes. It's like Simone trying the wig on, or Simone walking along the seawall, or Simone just watching Michael and desiring him and never being able to forget that, you know, always feeling that, really.
This business of the potentiality, sorry, I'll come to it in a second. I just wanted to follow this up if I could. The idea of things unraveling. You have a passage that you read to us about the wig, the coils being fixed and they would never unwind. Whereas the book is about unwinding and the fear of unwinding. Mm. And an awful lot of your fiction deals with the potential for people to do harm to themselves or to have harm done to them by others. Really terrible things happen in your fiction. And you live with those things in your imagination day after day. Can you talk about the experience of living with those things in that way?
I know, people do say that. Do say that. I don't find them bleak worlds to live in. In fact, I find them, because I think it's quite regenerative fiction. I would say, if I write something, it isn't ever despairing. There is a sense of regeneration. And I think, or I hope, that the characters and what happens to them and the places where they are and the food that they eat and the thoughts that they have and the way they lie in their beds are sufficiently gripping or absorbing or sensuous or pleasing that the fact that... I don't know that it is a tragic view of life at all, because the older I get, the more I realise that the lives of the people around me are infinitely more bizarre, more strange than anything. No, this is such a cliche, but it's true, than anything you could possibly write in a book. For example, Zenner in Darkness deals with the First World War. But if you read, for example, there's a book by Paul Fussell called The Great War and Modern Memory, and it is just full of extraordinary coincidences, things that happened in reality. So I don't find them dark to live with. In fact, I feel they're full of light, but that's
I didn't mean to imply that they were terribly depressing or that some sort of criticism of your work, but just that you do face up to very hard things. Sorry, there was a question here, and I'm...
Can I ask you where the choice of title fits into this? As far as the Luai boy is concerned, it's not really the contrast.
Yes.
So the choice of title in Your Blue-Eyed Boy and the... Yeah.
Well, it comes from this poem, which is towards the end of the book, and it's a poem by E.E. Cummings, which I'll just read it.
Yes, I do remember that.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Well...
I've actually read the book.
Oh, you've read it. Oh, great. Well, what I wanted was the idea of somebody... Can I read it for people who haven't read it? Okay. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? So
that comes at the end.
Yeah, that's the kind of payoff, really. Yeah, it's. I love that poem, and I've always felt, you know, who is this blue-eyed boy? He's the supreme object of desire, really. I mean, he's just so desirable, and that's what Michael is to Simone. And really, what seemed to me what E. Cummings was saying is, you know, death gets the blue-eyed boy, death gets the one that everybody wants, because the story is Michael's tragedy, really. I feel in the end, more than it's Simone's tragedy. I mean, I shouldn't, you know, go into all the detail, but in the end, I felt very, very deeply for him, because he's someone who's had a tremendous dream, which is always almost American dream, of, you know, creating a great place and an innocent life. It's almost Walden Pond, and it doesn't happen. So your blue-eyed boy, mind you, it doesn't work in every language. It was translated into Danish. And the serious thought about changing it, in some countries it was changed because something about, you know, the word dead is not good, which I couldn't really believe. But to me, your blue-eyed boy was the core of the book. And I do take the titles from poems. I've increasingly done that. I did it with Talking to the Dead, and I'm doing it with my next book. And I suppose it's a way of tying up, you know, being a poet and being a fiction writer in a way, and burying something, you know, usually burying a poem somewhere in the book for people to just to think and read and enjoy, I suppose.
Martin Amis's American publishers wouldn't have Dead Babies as a title. Ah. It's called Other People.
Rather different, really, isn't it?
It is a kind of different idea. Any other questions? Sorry.
This is a two-part question, really. Firstly, to what extent do you write from your own experience? How is your work at all autobiographical? And secondly, following on from that, how do you go about writing about events and scenarios that are outside of your own experience?
So it's a two-part question. Firstly, about the extent to which Helen Dunmore writes from her own experience, and secondly, about how she goes about writing in the bits of her books that aren't directly related to her experience.
Well, as I've just shown now, that, you know, for example, with the wig, that came from personal experience. I've usually found that the most unlikely parts tend to be the most autobiographical. And, you know, people think, oh, that can't possibly be, you know, from her own experience, and that is. Whereas the ones that seem very normal and everyday, I've laboured on. With a couple of the books that are set in a historical period, it's a bit more obvious in a way how you do the research, like A Spell of Winter and Xena in Darkness, which are both set before and during and after, in that case, the First World War. And really, that's a very large amount of researching and reading, almost until you feel at home there, until you feel that, you know, you're in a room and you can turn the light off and you can walk around. It's got to feel very natural. I think the period's got to feel very natural. And that's a quite time-consuming, that's a very lengthy process, because I'm myself very annoyed by books set in a historical period which have anachronisms in, unless they're deliberate anachronisms. And, you know, some writers do introduce deliberate, I mean, like Pat Barker did with her trilogy, she deliberately used anachronistic language because that was a decision that she made for, you know, for good reason. But if anachronisms are just sloppy and clumsy, then it makes me angry, and I mean, it's very embarrassing if you do it yourself. So with those two books, it was thinking about not just the time, but even the language, the way that people would have spoken and they would have thought. And but I still found that autobiographical things came into it, like in Xena in Darkness, my love of Xena and St. Ives and all that place, because it hasn't changed so very much, so you could still, and it's very not easy, but it's not so difficult to track back and find out. I mean, easier than it would be, say, with Coventry, but you can find out what it was like.
But I do, yeah, I do use autobiographical things. I mean, in Talking to the Dead, although it's very much based on, to some extent, on Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell's relationship, it's also based on my having sisters and wanting to write about sisters. And probably with all the books, there's a kind of fingerprint, and I suppose people who know me very well can see things as autobiographical, which, you know, other people might not. I'm probably quite careful in some ways. I mean, I wouldn't write a book like perhaps, some people will write about their marriages when the marriages have just ended and call it a novel. And I think there's problems. For me, there'd be a problem about doing that, and it's a problem to do with the power of the author to dominate the public arena by telling their version and to leave somebody else very powerless, you know. And I do have concerns about that in fiction, increasingly, this blurring, you know. But certainly I use autobiographical material. And just things like with the children in Your Blue-Eyed Boy. I think if you've lived with children and you've had children and you're thinking about the way they behave when they're eating fish and chips, or the way they squabble in the back of the car, or the way they, you know, they each try and get their mother's attention or whatever. I mean, that it does help to have the experience, although it's probably not essential. You know, there's people who write brilliantly about children who never had them.
Yeah, and Richard Ford would be an example of the latter category. Mm. Yeah, somebody. I'm thinking about the way you interlace the past and the present. I mean, you've written novels set in the past, of course, but you've also written, when you write about the present, characters tend to have distant memories which come back into their lives, or events that are worked into the present of the fiction. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing of time, which must take a great deal of organisational planning.
Yeah, to some extent it does, except when I'm writing, I tend not to think about their present as being the reality.
Yeah.
You know, I think very often in ordinary life we can think of the present is real and the past is slightly less real, I don't know. But with these characters, it's more like an archaeological layer that's exposed so that you can see all their presents and all their pasts together and move around. And my feeling, perhaps, is that the past isn't less real than the present. The past. To go back to the thing of the First World War, you know, why is it? Why is it that people are writing about the First World War? Why did I, in 1990 or 89 or whatever it was, start writing about 1917? You know, what was it that made that happen? That past is not dead. It's alive, and it's active, and it's still influencing us, and it's still affecting us. And I was very touched by seeing a television program with veterans going back to the battlefields, and particularly by the relationship between a man who must have been, I suppose, mid-30s, who was obviously very involved in taking the veterans out there, and just looking at what that past had done to him, you know, what it had drawn out of him and how it had changed his life, and the kind of very practical and realistic tenderness with which he was helping these old men to kind of take out their ears and their teeth and their, you know, and get, they were all about 100, and get into bed. And I thought, that war is not dead, because it has completely still changed the life of that young man. And why, you know, why am I writing about it? I hardly know, except that it seems not to have died down. In, you know, in Catherine Mansfield's famous phrase, she couldn't stop thinking about this story, it wouldn't die down. Mm. And I think the past sometimes just won't die down. It's like, you know, that famous Jacob wrestling with the angel, isn't it? I will not let you go unless you bless me. And it's like, with the First World War, right at the end of the century, it's kind of grabbing us and saying, you know, I won't let you go because you haven't understood me and you haven't blessed me with understanding. And there were those long middle years where it was almost, you know, people couldn't bear to talk about it or think about it. And now it's right at the end of the century, that wrestling has started again. And I find that fascinating.
You've used two biblical, calm, ecclesiastical phrases just now, the Jacob wrestling and the idea of a blessing. It occurs to me that, and you were mentioning earlier on in conversation about Graham Greene and Catholicism, and two of the themes that you've been referring to seem to connect with Catholicism, whether or not there's an influence there. One is the idea that the present and the past are not easily inextricable, and that there's a continuum, that the present isn't all we live in. Mm. The other is the idea of the judge becoming something more than a human being by taking on the vestments of a judge and becoming an emblem of justice. And something better and different from an ordinary human being, which is a very sacerdotal, priestly kind of way of seeing things. Now, you may feel this question is too personal, but do you feel that Catholicism is important to your work?
Well, I think in a very buried way it is, in a very kind of deep under the surface way. I mean, not in an overt way, in the way that Graham Greene,
sure.
You know, who I think was an apologist in many ways, you know, was very concerned to make everything come out right in a sense, although he kept subverting himself. But looking at the thing of garments, for example, I think it's very powerful. And Donald actually says to Simone, he says, judge not, lest you be judged. And he almost paralyzes her because she's thinking, I can't judge, you know, I can't, actually I'm not allowed to make any sort of judgment. And I think that is a very strong feeling that, you know, how dare we judge one another when we're all, you know, we're all equally vulnerable, equally full of error, and, you know, it's to actually imagine yourself judging is very hard. But on the other hand, the alternative is chaos, so you have to do something. I think I do tend to see my characters in a very large expanse of time. Mm. And I tend to think even when they die, they don't necessarily, that's not just sort of like, that's the end of them, you know. I continue to think about them. Other people continue. They have another life. Whether it's an afterlife in a very organized way, I don't know. But certainly in Your Blue-Eyed Boy, on one level it's a very realistic novel. On another level, it's not purely realistic because there's a kind of way in which the characters, even when they die, they carry on possessing one another. I'm thinking here perhaps more of a writer like Emily Bronte, who I think did that fantastically, this idea that you hungered for somebody so much that you still, you know, you just couldn't rest, you couldn't be quiet. So I think I'm interested in the whole dimension of the person rather than just, you know, the snapshot of them, probably. And the absurdity of them too, because it's quite funny sometimes the way you get yourself into a certain position in fiction or in life, and a character is in a very tortuous position and it leads them into all kinds of absurdities. And really, how did they get there? Suddenly they think, you know, how did I get into this position? Like Simone almost thinking, how did I let somebody push me that far? I never thought I could be pushed that far. I never thought I could turn into that kind of position. It isn't exactly funny, but there's certainly a sort of black comedy there, yeah. About human beings and where you get pushed to. And I'm interested in that.
Mm. You've just recently finished a book, is that right?
Yeah, I have. So I'm on holiday, so to speak. It feels like a holiday because I find writing fiction very exhilarating, but very tiring. And the last book, which took me, I suppose, about a year, was extremely, extremely tiring to write. So it is a wonderful holiday-like feeling when you finish one, actually, even if you're doing lots of other things. And a feeling of being one ahead, in a sense, because there is this pressure, you know, from publishers, kind of, you know, get the next one to us. Unconscious, well, they don't kind of ring you up and say, get the next one to you, but they might as well, because the pressure's on you. So when you feel this, I've done it, I've delivered it. And also then I have the feeling I'd like to write some poems. I'd like to I just wrote a little poem yesterday, which was actually a poem for somebody, a little birthday poem, and I thought, oh, this, you know, this feels so organised and sort of nice in scale, you know, and it was even to be thinking about rhyme and form and all that. It was just, it was quite a holiday feeling, really, really nice. So,
will you tell us anything about the book?
Well, I don't tend to. I don't really talk about
it. Fine, that's absolutely fine. If you don't want to do that, don't do it.
Besides, you can make anything sound good, can't you? But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, isn't it?
There's a question here. Yeah. The actual process of writing, is it fits and starts, or is there a very fixed routine?
Well, I pretend to keep to a routine. I mean, I'm always saying how well organised I am. And in a way I do, because of having a young child. I have a 4-year-old. She's just started school, so that's changed things. But I find when I'm really engrossed in a novel, particularly a long thing like a novel, I'll very often work late into the night. You know, I'll start work again perhaps about 9 o'clock, and I'll work on late, because then there isn't any ending to the time, you know, it's very open, and also the phone doesn't ring and there's nobody around and the children are in bed, and it's quite pleasant. But I suppose I have to be fairly organised. I mean, because if I were to wait until I really, really, really felt like doing it, you know, it wouldn't. You always have to push yourself a little bit, don't you? I think with any piece of work, you've got to push yourself into it. Though the only thing I did learn, it's a bit cliched, was a few years ago when I started really writing fiction. I can't remember who said it or whether I thought it up for myself. Probably not. Just don't leave it when you've driven it into the ground and when you're really tired. Do leave it with a bit of life. Or it's much nicer to start in the morning with a paragraph that you think is nearly okay, but you've just got to do a little bit of work on, than a whole great sort of new chapter. So I try and make it easy for myself, and I use, you know, like I'll have music on. I always have music on, so I can't hear anything outside the room. And but I don't think when you work with the young children, you can really have a very rigid routine, because there's so many unpredictable things that jump up at you. Having said that, I'm very good at telling other people, you know, to get into their studies at 9 a.m. and stay there till they've...
I like the idea of leaving things when they're going well and not waiting until they've gone well and used it all up. Graham Greene, certainly for quite a long stage of his work, did his 800 words a day, and he'd stop on number 800 even if it was the middle of a sentence.
Then
he could have a drink.
I do agree with the word counting, because it gives you a great sense of pleasure when you can come downstairs and say, well, you know, I did 1500 words or whatever, and you're not really thinking about at that point were they good or bad. You've done it, you know. if I could call a short story 1500 words, you know, it would be and then they do mount up, and then the whole, but I always find with every book there's a slightly crazy stage that I have to go through where I know I'm working too hard and I'm very near to an edge of overdoing it and everything seeming a bit unreal and slightly losing my mental balance, you know. Well, not totally, but I can feel it. And in a sense, you have to come quite close to that to do that last real push that makes a good book. But you have to be careful to kind of come away from it again. So you've got to let the kind of crazy period be limited, I think, if you can. And the problem is, I think what does happen to people sometimes is they can't get back again, you know.
This is where we feel we need the writer's family with us to give their view of the story.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what you're like in the morning.
Very easy to live with that.
Well, it's very nice of you, Helen, to have given up some time, even if you are on holiday, or perhaps especially when you're on holiday, to come all the way to Warwick and read to us and talk to us. I've learned a great deal from it, and I think everybody else has too. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.